Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Today is the 25th anniversary of a landmark album by the band R.E.M. Green was their major label debut, the album that catapulted them from top-line American underground heroes to international arena rockers. And, almost inevitably, the album that provoked cries of sellout from some fans. We'll take a look back at the record, both for its music and its lingering impact. Now, last time he was here on Soundcheck, R.E.M. guitarist Peter Buck told us that even though the band is broken up, they still have an office and they get together for meetings to discuss R.E.M. stuff. So we decided to mark the 25th anniversary of Green by calling their office, where we reached bass player Mike Mills. Do you have a favorite song from the record? I mean, one that you just, you know, even 25 years later, just kind of stands up for you?
That's a good question. Orange Crush was always one of my favorite songs to play live.
Got my spine, I've got my orange crush.
Whenever I made the set list, I always put that one in there because it's just so much fun to sing and play. I kind of love World Leader Pretend. I think that's a song that I didn't like as much when we first put it together, and it really grew on me, and it became one of my favorite songs.
Know the barricades. I know the mortar and the walls. I recognize the weapons.
World Leader Pretend, recorded live on a bonus CD being issued with the 25th anniversary edition of R.E.M.'s Green. We'll hear more from Mike Mills of R.E.M. on the making of this record in just a bit. Oh, and the Australian band Hiatus Coyote is celebrating an anniversary today, too. Back in September, Prince tweeted his many followers and told them to check out the band's song Nakamura. So today, on the 47th dayversary of Prince's tweet, the band will play that song for us live in the studio. All right, let's start with our real anniversary. R.E.M.'s Green came out 25 years ago today, and J. Edward Keyes, the editor-in-chief of eMusic, is here to tell us what it all meant. Joe, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thanks. Good to be back.
This was a polarizing album at the time, wasn't it?
It sure was. I actually think it kind of continues to be to this day. The band, at the point that it was released, had really cultivated a reputation as underground darlings. They'd recorded for the label IRS. Their first few records were perceived as very mysterious. Michael Stipe wasn't really enunciating when he was singing. But they hit a point of personal frustration a little bit. They released the record Document and kind of felt that they had gone as far as they could go, and a major was the next logical step. But at the time, the stigma of an indie darling jumping to a major was pretty strong.
And they were not unaware that they were probably going to be accused of selling out by doing this record. And in fact, right off the top, track one, they kind of address that, it seems.
Yeah, it's very cannily called Pop Song 89. But if you listen to the lyrics, there's a trace of irony in it. They seem on the surface very facile. Hello, how are you? I know you. I knew you. But there's little tweaks along the way. Should we talk about the weather? Should we talk about the government? They're sort of subverting the pop form while utilizing it.
That's called Pop Song 89 from the 1988 record called Green. We're marking its 25th anniversary on Soundcheck today.
Joe, you mentioned the album that came before Green, Document, and you said that they were sort of frustrated, that they felt as they'd gone as far as they could. Do you mean they'd gone as far as they could with the support of an independent label?
Yeah, exactly. One of the things that Peter Buck, the guitar player for REM, often talks about in interviews is they were getting frustrated that their albums that were released on IRS had no international distribution. Mm. And they really felt like they were stymied by the label's reach. At the same time, they felt maybe a little bit exploited by the label. They were certainly the largest act on the label at the time. And they felt like for the good of the band, they needed to make the next logical leap to a place that could get them out of America and give them a little more support when they toured internationally. And Warner Brothers seemed to be giving them the best offer at the time.
So was that really the case, that their international profile was that low? I mean, here in the States, they seem to be everywhere.
To listen to them tell it, they were struggling anytime they went overseas. They'd see the album sales weren't what they were in the States. Their profile wasn't as large as it was. And if you look at the difference between what they did with Document and then Green, which I think charted at something like number 27 maybe in the UK, which was their best chart showing to date, you can really see the difference that the support of an international major label made.
But if you go back to Document, you know, there are songs there that were kind of ubiquitous here in the States, including this one.
This one goes out to the one I've left behind. A simple prop to occupy my time. This one goes out to the one I love. Fire!
The One I Love, a single from REM's previous album, Document, which came out in 1987. It was their last album on IRS Records, the indie label they'd been with pretty much from the beginning. We're talking, though, about Green, their major label debut, a milestone for the band REM. J. Edward Keyes, editor-in-chief of eMusic, here with me on Soundcheck. Joe, what is your reaction listening to the album again 25 years later?
It's funny to go back to it, and it's especially funny to hear that clip of The One I Love, because there were so many accusations, as we talked about, of the band selling out, but sonically, the kinds of songs they were writing really weren't very different from the kinds of things they had been doing even on Document.
Right.
If anything, listening to Green now highlights kind of how experimental the band was willing to be for their first major label records. There's songs on that record that really point the direction that they were going to follow with Out of Time and then later Automatic for the People.
So you mean like switching instruments and stuff like that? You know, basically had a band, as you said before, they'd been around for 7 or 8 years. They were trying to try new things.
Exactly. They were getting restless with the way that they'd written songs before. They kind of wanted to reinvent the way they were writing. And so they tried things like, there's the first kind of experiment with the mandolin on this record, which became so crucial to their sound later on. The song The Wrong Child, eerie layered vocals, kind of minor key and spooky. The same for the song I Remember California. There's a lot of darkness on this record that was even absent from the records they'd made on an indie up to that point.
I'll try to make a happy game to play. Come play.
Now, what was your, I mean, where were you in your life when you first heard this record?
It was pretty weird. This was actually the album that introduced me to REM, and I've become my favorite band. I was growing up a born-again Christian kid in the suburbs of New York, and so born-again Christian meant MTV was off limits. The only exposure to music videos I had was one music video show on the Family Channel that was 90% Christian music videos with like a handful of secular music videos that were deemed to be okay. Like they passed the bar. They were family friendly. It was on at about 11 o'clock at night. And one of the episodes of this show, they showed a live clip from the song I Could Turn You Inside Out from the Green Tour. And I remember sitting there watching in that moment as a kid who felt it was the boon of hard rock, which I felt really alienated from, hard rock being really aggressively masculine, all the front men of those bands, despite how they dressed, all the songs were about chicks or beer or whatever, and I couldn't relate to that at all. And I remember seeing Michael Stipe, the front man from this band, hugely popular on stage on an arena, dancing the way he danced and looking the way he looked. And it was a lightning bolt moment for me as this Christian kid of the suburbs saying, that. I relate to that. I get it. Like, it was good to know that somebody could be in front of a band and not telegraph the way all these other kind of male lead vocalists were.
So just to be clear, when you say looking the way he looked and dancing the way he did, he's sort of not quite Morrissey or Ian Curtis of Joy Division, but, you know, kind of a weird mover, would you say? And
yeah, really erratic dancing. I remember he was shirtless. He had a really long braid down the back of his head, and he had black raccoon eye makeup around his eyes. It's like nothing I'd ever seen before. And for somebody who's so desperate, who felt so alienated from pop culture at large, to have that moment of finally here's a thing that I can relate to was really powerful to me as a young kid.
So for Joe, his experience with the album Green turned on this song called Turn You Inside Out. From REM's major label debut, the album called Green. We're celebrating the 25th anniversary of this REM record today. That's a song called Turn You Inside Out, an apt title for our guest, J. Edward Keyes, E! Music's editor-in-chief. The critical response to this album was all over the map, it seems. This guy in the LA Times, Mike Bohm, had written something like, let me read it. REM's least consistent album, though he then goes on to say the batting average remains high. So I'm not sure what that means.
Well, you know, the thing that I think he calls out there, the terms of the lack of consistency, is really a testament to how much the band was pushing themselves. You had 11, really, songs that were all over the stylistic map. The B-side of it is a lot harder and more aggressive than they'd been before. It was a lot darker. And then on the A-side, they were experimenting. We talked a bit about the mandolin-driven song You Are the Everything. There were some really pretty songs. They tried their first foray into a real calculated pop single on the first side as well, to mixed results.
All right, well, let's talk about Stand. I mean, there were lots of people, I might have been one of them, who found this song really annoying. But it was everywhere. I mean, it was a big hit for them.
Yeah, I'm actually pretty anti-Stand myself, and I say that as a diehard REM fan. I think the funny thing looking back on both Stand and then later Shiny Happy People were...
Which is from a later record.
Yeah, from Out of Time, the record that followed this. I think the thing that I take from it now is when REM went out of their way to try to consciously write a pop single, those songs dated really quickly, and it always seems like it's the ones they didn't expect that remain the most timeless.
It wishes for trees, the trees would be falling. Listen to reason, reason is calling. Your feet are going to be on the ground.
Think about it.
So that's the single Stand from R.E.M.'s record called Green, issued 25 years ago, a watershed moment for the band. And Joe, you're saying that, you know, when they actually consciously tried to do a pop song, it was often, as you say, those songs would date very quickly. But there was another big single on this record, Orange Crush, which I never knew what that song. I mean, is it about a soda? Is it about the Denver Broncos? What is that? And yet it's one of those earworms. That one you could not get out of your head.
And again, I feel like an odd choice for a pop single. It is pretty ruthless. It's really aggressive. The drums hit really hard. And it's a song about Agent Orange.
Is that what it's about?
Yeah. Michael Stipe's father was in the military, and it's about the debilitating effects of Agent Orange over a long period of time. That's why there's late in the song you can hear what sounds like a voice over a CB talking about soldiers in a helicopter circling the jungle and looking for. So it's got, again, there's a classic example, not elements you would think that would be a pop song and certainly a song that has stood the test of time. Whereas Stand, which is a little more lightweight, I think neither of us can really tolerate too much at this point.
We're speaking with J. Edward Keyes. He's editor-in-chief of eMusic and a big R.E.M. fan, and we are marking the 25th anniversary of R.E.M.'s album Green, their first on a major label on Warner Brothers. We were talking before, Joe, about how the critics were pretty lukewarm, kind of a mixed bag of reactions to this record. I was quoting from Mike Bohm in the L.A. Times earlier. He talks about the song Hair Shirt. He says, "The aptly named Hair Shirt, the first truly awful song R.E.M. has produced." Do you agree?
No. People hate this song, and I think it's beautiful. I don't know if that's just a testament to my own weird aesthetic or what. I really like the kind of weirdly romantic aspect. But the first line of the song is, "I'm not the type of dog that could keep you waiting." But something about it is moving. Something about the way he sings it, I feel like it's a song full of yearning. It's a really pining romantic song that almost everyone hates except me.
"I am not the type of dog that could keep you waiting for no good reason. Run a carbon black test on my jaw. I can swing my megaphone and long arm the rest. It's easier and better to just beat it from the chest of desire."
That's R.E.M., the song Hair Shirt from their album Green. And Joe, with the benefit of hindsight, you hear that mandolin and you think, intimations of what's coming next, right?
Absolutely. I think even in his vocal delivery, you can hear that same, he's tapping wells of emotion that he hadn't really hit before, that he would go on to really succeed in Automatic for the People.
And what about, you know, Out of Time, you know, this album that really seemed to unlock the whole unplugged scene of the 90s? You know, that we hear intimations of that in this song.
Absolutely. And I think the other trait that's kind of carried between the two records is this sense of reckless experimentation in a positive way. Out of Time, if you revisit it now, is also all over the map. The first song has KRS-One on it. There's a spoken word song that goes on for 7 minutes. I feel like Green was the passageway to all these things that defined the latter part of REM's career, depending on your perspective, for better or for worse. But I feel like this was the signpost.
All right. So looking at this album, knowing that it was sort of the key to what are generally considered to be some of their greatest records in the next couple of years, where does Green stack up?
I would put Green somewhere near the top of the list of their Warner records. I actually like it a bit more than Out of Time, which I feel like feels more scattershot to me. In retrospect. But on the other hand, I'm also a guy who really likes Monster, which is generally one of their most hated records. So maybe my REM radar is kind of off.
You did say that you're a big REM fan. So, listeners, what do you think of Green on its 25th anniversary? You can call us, leave us a voicemail, 866-939-1612, or post a comment on our website, soundcheck.org. 866-939-1612. We've been marking the 25th anniversary of REM's major label debut, the album Green. J. Edward Keyes, editor-in-chief of eMusic. Joe, good to have you back with us.
Thanks. Always good to be here.
Feed me banks of light, hang your hair, shirt on your lowest rung. It's a beautiful light.
Up next, my conversation with one of the members of REM, bassist Mike Mills, joins us to look back at the album Green. And later, the Australian band Hiatus Coyote describes their music as future soul. Hear what that sounds like later on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. 25 years ago today, in 1988, the Athens, Georgia band REM released an album called Green. It was their major label debut, following five acclaimed albums released on the independent IRS label. The music critic Joe Keyes described some of his favorite moments from the album a moment ago, but let's hear from one of the principal players. Mike Mills is the founding bassist of REM and joins me on the line. Mike, welcome to Soundcheck.
Glad to be here.
So asking you to talk about one record out of the many you've done, I suppose, is a little like asking a parent to pick a favorite among their kids. But what's special about Green 25 years later?
Oh, wow. Well, I think it was really the sort of record that took us worldwide. The tour in 1989 took us to a lot of places we'd never been. And that record and Warner Brothers distribution enabled us to see the world, basically.
Mm-hmm. So when we were talking earlier with Joe Keyes about, you know, the ability of a Warner Brothers to take you places where you couldn't go before, was that really one of the main kind of propulsions to leave IRS and go to a major label?
It was actually one of the main reasons. We loved IRS Records, and they were the perfect label for us for five records. And, you know, I have nothing but good things to say about all the people there. But it was very frustrating to go to Europe and, you know, have no one there be able to find our record. And, you know, it wasn't like we were bent on world domination. At the same time, we felt like if we were going over there and slogging it around, we might as well have the record available for people to get. So, we looked at a lot of different labels that had worldwide distribution, and you know, we loved Warner Brothers primarily because of two reasons. The two guys that ran it, Mo Austin and Lenny Waronker, were definitely music guys and not you know, bean counters in suits and that sort of thing. And then their roster, which also, you know, stemmed from Mo and Lenny's musical involvement, their roster had a lot of people that they had because they were great musicians and made great records, not because they sold millions of copies. Mm-hmm. And that definitely appealed to us.
Now, you guys at this point had been a band for about 8 years. You already had five records under your belt. Where was the band at mentally in the making of Green?
we were in a really good place mentally, but we were ready to branch out a little bit musically. You know, we had gotten to the point of switching instruments a lot. Peter was moving away from strictly electric guitar and wanted to record on you know, different stringed instruments.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided to branch out a little bit with some of these songs. There's a few mandolin songs on there, some more acoustic things. You know, the accordion makes a few appearances that it hadn't been quite as dominant before. So we just decided to see what we could do if we shook things up a little bit.
Is that why people sometimes refer to Green as an experimental record? Is that what you think that's what they're talking about?
I can only imagine. I didn't find it that necessarily that experimental, but I guess, you know, when you've got band members playing instruments that aren't their primary instrument, it's going to sound experimental.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think there were maybe it was a little more, at least on some songs, acoustically driven than previous records.
So do you have is there a favorite track from the album that sort of, for you, sort of epitomizes what you're talking about, that willingness to try a new sound?
Yes, I guess if you want one track that's the epitome of that record, it'd probably have to be You Are the Everything. It's elegant, it's beautiful, it's fairly simple, it's mostly mandolin and accordion, some of Michael's most evocative lyrics. I really enjoy that song in terms of, you know, picking one off the record to describe the whole thing.
Sometimes I feel like I can't even sing. I'm very scared for this world. I'm very scared for me. This erase your memory. Here's a scene. You're in the backseat, laying down. The windows wrap around to the sound of the travel and the engine. All you hear is time stand still in travel. You feel such peace and absolute stillness still that doesn't end but slowly drifts into sleep. The stars are the greatest thing you've ever seen, and they're there for you. For you alone, you are the everything.
That's some music from Green, the album by R.E.M. We're celebrating the 25th anniversary of the release today on Soundcheck, and the song You Are the Everything, Mike Mills just telling us that it sort of represents the more experimental side of the band in the studios and the making of this record. Mike Mills, the founding bassist of R.E.M., on the line with me. What were the sessions like? I mean, you know, one of the things we were talking about earlier is that the sound of the record is not so different, you know, production-wise, from what you guys had done before. Was there any different kind of a feeling in the studio itself?
You know, there was definitely some excitement because we knew that this record would be heard and judged by a lot more people than previous records had been. Partly due to Warner Brothers and partly due to our sort of, you know, fortunate growth and expansion of our audience. So, we were excited, but we also knew we had something good going on. And at the same time, it was a little, part of the excitement came from the fact that we were trying to do something a little different with the mandolin and sort of combining acoustic songs with hard rockers and things like Turn You Inside Out and Orange Crush.
Right. And were you guys, you must have been aware that by jumping to a major label, there were going to be horrified cries of sellout from at least a portion of the R.E.M. community. How much of that was in the back of your mind or in actual open conversation when you were making the record?
We didn't really worry about people screaming sellout because we knew what we were doing and why. And, you know, if we could have gotten more money from other labels, you know, we did not take the richest contract offered to us for sure, because that's not what we were after. And so we didn't really worry about that. You know, our only concern was really pleasing ourselves and the producer you know, once if the five of us felt good about what we were doing, then we didn't really worry too much about what anyone else thought. I mean, as I say, we were aware that it would be, you know, heard and judged by people, but you don't really think about that while you're making the record, or we don't anyway.
I suppose that would be a really kind of confining thing if you were thinking about it. We're speaking with Mike Mills, the bassist from the band REM, on the 25th anniversary of Green, the band's major label debut, which is now out in a 25th anniversary edition that includes a live disc from the 1989 World Tour. And why was the album called Green?
It was actually for several different reasons. You know, we were certainly environmentally conscious, and that was part of it. I think we just liked the word, and of course, you know, we knew that people were talking about all the money that we had supposedly made by signing this new record contract. So we decided to make a little ironic nod to the thing that was in the ether about what we'd done. So, you know, we were always a band that had a lot of inside jokes, and that was just another one.
Okay. And Mike, looking back, do you have a favorite song from the record? I mean, without regard to how it was made or whether it was experimental or not, but one that you just, you know, even 25 years later, just kind of stands up for you?
You know, that's a good question. I always, Orange Crush was always one of my favorite songs to play live. Whenever I made the set list, I always put that one in there because it's just so much fun to sing and play.
Is that something you guys would sort of switch? You know, would it be different people, different nights making up the set list?
It was almost always Peter making the set list, but some nights, you know, when you play hundreds of shows, eventually you're like, somebody else please do it tonight. So if I would do it, I would always stick Orange Crush in there.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we hear that song from the live concert version, the album that comes with the special 25th anniversary edition of REM's Green. Meanwhile, we've been speaking with Mike Mills, the bassist, founding member of REM, on the 25th anniversary of the release of the album. Mike, thanks very much for speaking with us.
It was my pleasure, John. Thank you.
Got my spine, I've got my orange crush.
That's REM performing Orange Crush, recorded live in North Carolina at the Greensboro Coliseum in November of 1989. Again, we want to hear what you think of REM's album Green. Leave us a message at 866-939-1612 or post a comment at soundcheck.org. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The band Hiatus Coyote came together in Melbourne, Australia, but quickly found success online via word of mouth from some pretty big-name acts across the world. Erykah Badu says she's in love with the band. Prince has tweeted about them, and Q-Tip from A Tribe Called Quest has rapped with them. Hiatus Coyote joins me here in the Soundcheck studio today. They're going to play some tracks off their debut album, Talk Tomahawk. Here's a song called Lace Skull. This is Hiatus Coyote, live on Soundcheck.
Lace skull. filled up the well. You never could tell who threw the first stone. They say cold, come home, and at the ocean's velvet of fame, going to heaven first only for a second. Softly as a feather.
That is the Australian band Hiatus Coyote performing live here in our New York studio on Soundcheck. The song is called Lace Skull, and you will find a version of it on the band's first album called Talk Tomahawk, which is out now. The members of Hiatus Coyote include Napalm, N-A-I-P-A-L-M, Napalm singing and playing guitar, Simon Maven on keyboards, Bender, just Bender, playing the bass, and Perrin Moss behind our drum kit here in the Soundcheck studio, and Simon and Nay joining me at the microphones at the moment. And Simon, that's not a representative track from the record. I'm not sure there is a representative track because it's all over the place, isn't
it? Yeah, that one's probably the most unique one on the record, I think. I mean,
it's got a little of everything. It's got some jazzy chords. It's got, you're doing, especially at our piano like that, there's a kind of classical element that maybe I didn't hear on the record.
Yeah, absolutely. It was one of the first songs that we actually, one of Ney's original compositions that we actually kind of arranged together.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my sort of first impression of the band as well.
Really?
So I heard it and we sort of worked on this tune and I was like, oh, this is kind of Jeff Buckley influences and more sort of rocky thing. And then
right,
he started
right.
playing other tunes and it was like, wow, there is no sort of influence
right.
on this.
So Nafe, people who listen to the record, they'll hear, yes, this, as Simon says, this kind of Jeff Buckley influence thing, but then there's also a lot of very soul-inflected stuff, some instrumental pieces that veer off into other territory. let me be the first person ever to ask the question, where does the band name come from?
I was sitting with some friends and we were throwing buzzwords around and it just kind of got plucked out of the ether, really. I mean, Coyote isn't actually a word.
No.
But when we...
But it's close to a couple of words.
It's close to Coyote, to Coyote and Peyote. And when we Googled it, it was a bird appreciation society around the world. And
Really?
I used to have a pet crow and I live with wildlife care. So it was very... It was like an omen kind of thing.
So there really is a coyote.
Coyote is like the spelling that we have is a bird appreciation society somewhere in the world.
Who knew?
But the reason we chose a word that was a bit intangible like that is because it involves the listener's creativity into how they perceive it, and that's very much a strong element of our music. Is like we try to draw on a lot of different influences, so it's not just spelling something out for people, because then they can engage with it in their own way.
So. Right. So if you're not being explicit as to what a song is about, we as listeners have to kind of figure that out for ourselves, and you're going to get lots of different interpretations.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's the beautiful thing about art is, you know, that it can reach people on different levels.
Now, let me ask you, I mean, you mentioned, you know, this kind of made-up word with elements of coyote and peyote. So, you know, those are terms that we often associate with Native Americans, especially from the southwest of this country.
Yeah.
And you guys have a song. In fact, you're going to do it for us in a minute or two, called Nakamara, which goes to sort of Native Australian culture. So is that the I don't know, is there a connection that you guys are making between Native cultures, Indigenous cultures?
I think
definitely, yeah. I think it's just like the same kind of thing that we were talking about before with Lay Skull being so different. Like, our influences are just from whatever we think is good, you know. So if something is happening in Antarctica, we're going to check it out and we're probably going to like it and then, you know, reference it in our music. So it's not really a specific native thing. It's just more a thing of, wow, that sounds amazing. I'm into that. You know,
right.
And it sort of comes representative in your music.
Right? And it's that juxtaposition of, like, even, like, with the live element of what we're doing, as well as the production, more textual, technological side of things. So it's celebrating both, and, you know, like, there's so much beauty in the ancient traditions of the world, you know, and it's crazy inspiring. But also, like, the flip side of that is also, you know, really incredible to draw from, so...
Well, yeah, and you know, the song that I mentioned, Nakamara, in the reissued, now you guys released the album Talk Tomahawk yourselves initially. Now it's come out on Flying Buddha, which is an imprint of Sony Masterworks, so a major label. And the reissue has Q-Tip from A Tribe Called Quest dropping a verse in, which seems to go towards, you know, talking about cultures, cultural imperialism, the suppression of some cultures, the elevation of others, and your name, Nay Palm. I mean, there's sort of an implied political statement there as well.
Well, my name is Naomi, and I used to be a fire dancer when I was younger, so that's where that comes from. But also, I like incorporating...
Big difference between napalm and fire dancing, isn't there?
There's a... For sure, but there's definitely that kind of link there. And I also like to incorporate... I mean, the fact that it has such negative connotations and to kind of associate it in a positive way, I think is almost... I'm very much into that.
What are the connotations of... What is fire dancing?
It's dancing with fire toys.
So you mean like with like lit torches and stuff like that?
No, there's like specific... like poi and stuff. And I used to have fire swords. So there's like...
Fire swords.
Yeah.
Because... Flaming torches wouldn't be dangerous enough.
Right.
Flying swords is much better.
Well, it's fun. So,
do you still do it?
I find less time to do it now, but I definitely want to get back into it.
Really? I would say, I would urge you not to quit your day job.
Well, it used to be my day job. Yeah. So.
We're listening to the Australian band Hiatus Coyote. They are performing for us today here in the Soundcheck studio. Having mentioned this song, Nakamura, you guys want to play it for us?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Once again, a live performance in the Soundcheck studio. The band from Melbourne, Australia is called Hiatus Coyote. The album is called Talk Tomahawk. It is out now. This song is on it in a version that includes the rapper Q-Tip. We'll just hear the band performing it here on Soundcheck.
Ooh.
The band is Hiatus Coyote from Melbourne, Australia, playing live here in our New York studio on Soundcheck with a song called Nakamura. Their album is called Talk Tomahawk, and it's out now. Let's hear another song. This one is called Building a Ladder. Once again, it's Hiatus Coyote.
Then we
The song's called Building a Ladder. It's a new one from the Australian band Hiatus Coyote, playing live here in the studio. Obviously, there's more to this session. Check out this full song and a bit more of our conversation with the band and videos that we've been shooting, and which are definitely worth checking out. All of that on our website, soundcheck.org. That's going to do it for today. Tomorrow, Google launched the YouTube Music Awards this past weekend, and now they're working on a subscription music service to compete with Spotify and iTunes. Steve Knopper of Rolling Stone tells us about Google's grand musical plan. And the story of a folk music institution in upstate New York. Cafe Lena in Saratoga Springs has hosted Bob Dylan, Arlo Guthrie, and hundreds of others. Plus a stripped-down and, we hope, profanity-free set from the band Swearin'. That's tomorrow on the show. But online, dig into our archives and watch videos of our in-studio performances on soundcheck.org. That does it for the program today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.